The History of War and Society grew out of a desire to write more than just traditional military history, a history of strategy and tactics and weapons systems. Yet it has in turn been criticized for studying everything but killing and dying, of discreetly averting its gaze from the blood, sweat, and terror of battle. The challenge to write a more experiential history of war has been most persuasively met by historians of the 20th century. They're endowed with appropriate sources, memoirs, interviews, psychiatric surveys, sources generated after a romantic watershed which made reflection on individual experience a more acceptable activity for the novel reading classes. They're also dealing with armies conscripted from among the civilian population, who had to be prepared en masse to confront the alien face of war. Yet Henry VIII's forces too were full of men pulled suddenly away from the plough and the loom and the fishing boat. How ready were they? What kind of soldiers did they become? And was their experience of war most likely to be a death sentence or an adventurous career break? Englishmen were supposed to own weapons appropriate to their social rank, and their enemies thought they knew how to use them. The French ambassador, Charles de Marillac, told the governor of Picardy in 1541, "You will understand well enough that all Englishmen are skilled in war after a fashion." But governments worried that after a fashion might not be good enough, and held musters with increasing regularity from the 1520s, at which all adult men were supposed to present their weapons for view. Muster returns can be combined with wills and probate inventories to trace the private ownership of arms and armour, but each presents problems. Muster returns, even those for the ambitious general prescription of 1522, are highly variable in the detail they record and whether they noted what people actually brought to musters or what they should have brought. At least for 1522, we have a tabulation of the returns for 27 counties, suggesting that there were enough bows and bills to equip 98% of the 128,250 able men who appeared at musters, but that there was armour for only a quarter of them. This figure of something over 30,000 able and equipped men matches fairly well the total numbers of troops put into the field in 1513. And the ratio of armour to able men persisted into the musters of 1539 and beyond. Wills and inventories are of less statistical use, telling us mostly about the older and richer parts of the population, and perhaps not enumerating weapons even when testators possessed them. But what they can do is give us a sense of the variety of arms and what they meant to their owners. Richard Thornton, Alderman of York, had no ordinary brigandines, but brigandines covered with tawny satin and gilt nails. John Broadoak, apothecary of Southampton, had no mere handgun, but a dag, a courier, and a stylish handgun laid with bone. And some testators bequeathed items, sometimes lovingly enumerated, to their sons or brothers or nephews or godsons or friends in a way that suggests their attachment to them. The patterns of ownership and trajectories of change these sources reveal are roughly parallel with the development of communal and lordly armories, though with some surprises, like the frequent ownership of bows and other weapons by clergymen. The ownership of arms and armour generally correlated with wealth, as a comparison of muster and subsidy returns shows. Swords are not often mentioned at musters, but appear as often as bows in wills and inventories, so they must have been common. And at least until the 1540s, all main rivets were outnumbered by older or more miscellaneous harness. Port towns kept up best with change. At Southampton, all main rivets were frequent from the 1550s, and by the 1570s, some testators had corslets and morions, whereas the best Oxfordshire could show before 1575 were the all main rivets of one great Milton husbandman and one Banbury shoemaker. It was the same with weaponry. At Southampton, 13 pikes were produced at musters in 1556, 109 in 1561, and they appear in inventories too. Handguns, infinitesimally few until the 1530s, spread first in towns from the 1540s, and were becoming common by the musters of 1569. In Cornwall, there were 22 at Bodmin, 20 at Saltash, 15 each at Truro and Foy. But guns were also scattered through the countryside, particularly in the richer eastern hundreds. And accidents with guns reflect their diffusion. Some regions had specialities. In West Cornwall, they brought slings to musters. In South Wales, long spears. In North Wales, clubs. And the proportion of horsed and armed men was much higher in the north than in the south or Midlands, twice as high in Cumberland or the North Riding of Yorkshire. Inventories show that people lived with weapons all over their houses. They were most often in the hall, followed by galleries for those who had them. But we find swords and bows in bedchambers, handguns in the parlour, and pole axes in counting houses. One man kept his sallet and splints in the kitchen cupboard, and another kept his in the cheese chamber. The social distribution of the ownership of arms and armour might lead us to ask whether their possession was aspirational, even consumerist. In high society, it surely was. The customers of Henry's luxury Greenwich armourers included the poets Wyatt and Surrey, the northern peers Lord Neville and the Earl of Cumberland, and the captains of Calais and Boulogne, Lords Maltravers and Poynings. One level down from them, the London mercer and future alderman Vincent Randall, ordering armour from Antwerp in 1551, was equally picky. He told his servant, Thomas Cranfield, that he wanted a mail coat after the most best fashion and the easiest to both to go or ride in and to take off and on, together with a steel cap, as is most used and occupied of the best sort and fashion, and covered over with silk. Further down still, did village notables buy arms and armour out of a dull sense of obligation? Or if a Greenwich armour had the same sexy glint as a sports car, did a well-made set of all-main rivets have the allure of a Ford Capri or an Audi Quattro? The jurors explaining an accident at Bridgewater in 1517 can't have been entirely tongue-in-cheek when they said it started with two men wanting to show each other the beauty of their swords. Some wore armour to commit robberies, or riots, or make a brave show in the courtroom, but guns were much more versatile, and they became the must-have purchase of the mid-century. Their attraction was enhanced by the fact that, like luxury clothing, their ownership was limited by statute to those of a certain wealth, with the aim of deterring poaching and rebellion and encouraging archery. The complaints of those who thought the rules were not enforced hard enough, gentlemen fond of hawking, for example, who saw their prey blasted out of the sky by plebs with guns before they had the chance to hunt it, suggest that the cachet conferred by the laws only made guns more desirable. As coroner's inquests show, not only were they useful for game shooting and pest control, they were a great, though risky, defence against burglars. Kings wanted subjects not just to possess weapons, but to know how to use them. By the 1560s, musters involved training delivered by muster masters, but long before that, muster commissioners checked the ability to fight. They counted half or more of the adult male population too immature, too old, too insecure and transient, or as some commissioners explicitly stated, too sick or lame when the musters were taken to fight at all. Even among the able, distinctions were made between archers and billmen, and between the mean or indifferent, the second sort or third sort, and the good or best or choice men. The logical next step, after identifying who owned equipment and who was fit to fight, was to reallocate arms and armour from richer and perhaps older men who owned it to the younger, fitter, and perhaps more expendable. And in 1522-3, this was clearly attempted. But rich old men in village and town elites did not always put their armour on poor young men and send them off to die. On the contrary, the better sort were sometimes happy to be counted choice men. In Yorkshire, in the 1530s, the list of able archers, horsed and harnessed for each township, was often headed by gentlemen or even esquires. Michael Rawdon of Rawdon, Lawrence Keithley of Newell, John Gascoigne of Barrack in Elmet, John Middleton of Kirkstall. In Wiltshire, in 1539, yeomen rich enough to own armour and horse were listed as able archers in one village after another. In Devon, in 1569, we know the names not only of those who owned equipment and those able to fight, but also of the village notables who supplied the information. The position of first named able archer seems to have been a particular mark of standing, manliness, and skill. In a string of villages from Black Autumn and Bratton Clavelly to Washford Pine and Zeal Monachorum, it was occupied not just by the richest farmers, but by presenters who nominated themselves. How did men learn to use weapons? Any physical activity was in one sense preparation for war. Ploughmen in particular were thought to have the muscles needed for archery, unlike weedy shepherds. Wrestling, Coroner's Inquest show us, was a popular recreation and a test of virility. For the gentry, hunting encouraged bold riding, risk-taking, and bloodshed. But some weapons clearly demanded special practice, above all archery, particularly archery with bows of the heavy pull weight needed for armor-piercing arrows. Regular practice was enjoined by statute and proclamation, and in some places at least, towns like Fordwich and Ludlow, enforced by fines on defaulters. Coroner's inquests showed dozens of fatalities at practice right across England, as gentlemen and yeomen, butchers, weavers and shoemakers, husbandmen, labourers and boys, shooters and spectators honed their skills. Archery practice shaped men's bodies, as skeletons of the Battle of Towton and the Mary Rose show, and it shaped the way they judged distance. In recording his journeys across England and Wales, John Leland expressed distances 36 times in flight shots, arrow shots, bow shots, or butt shots. Accident statistics suggest the decline of archery practice over the century, as bows became more expensive, less demanded by governments at war, and less exciting than guns. Meanwhile, as handguns spread, so did the ability to shoot them. From handfuls of urban residents in the 1520s and 30s, many of them foreigners, to hundreds per county in 1569, 314 in Oxfordshire, 492 in Cornwall. Firing larger guns was a skilled trade. Its secrets, contained in manuscript manuals or learnt by apprenticeship, steadily mastered by the English and Welsh, until they furnished all the master gunners of the early Elizabethan navy, except perhaps one. As for hand-to-hand combat, fighting with swords or swords and bucklers, small round shields for parrying blows, was popular, as accidents, star chamber cases, and even penances imposed on sword-fighting priests suggest. Some communities offered prizes for buckler playing, but London tried to ban it from the open streets and lanes of the city, and to shut down sword-fighting schools. From the 1550s, matters were complicated by the rise of the rapier, with its deadly point and sharp cutting edges, well designed for murder and evident death, and the masters of defence who taught its use. Such masters also taught the use of the bill, but this was comparatively uncomplicated, as it was related to agricultural tools, and using it in combat drew on the skills of quarterstaff fighting, an activity which crops up in coroner's inquests and in star chamber cases. Other staff weapons, accidents suggest, must have demanded some practice to get used to the weight of the head on the staff. Fighting from horseback demanded considerable control of one's horse, and Thomas Blunderville set out a rigorous programme of war horse training, including the firing of guns and a routine to accustom horses to advance against armed men on foot, deploying threateningly noisy servants who would conveniently retreat as the horse nerved itself to charge them. But take care not to hit the horse, lest you utterly discourage him forever. He didn't say anything about not discouraging the servants. Jousting at court or at Calais gave gentlemen practice in fighting with the lance, but different types required different techniques, as there were complaints when northern horsemen, used to lances which were round and light, were supplied with excessively great and bostious spears from the Ordnance Office. Even putting on armour took practice, and the London livery companies paid armourers to help their men get dressed for marching watches and musters, occasions which must have got men used to wearing armour and marching with weapons, one of Henry Barrett's training practices in his Captain's Handbook of 1562. Though dented by the Reformation, some towns strove to maintain or revive marching watches in the 1550s and 60s, or merged them with increasingly elaborate musters. And meanwhile, it became fashionable to put on more lifelike displays to demonstrate familiarity with the modern wars of firearms and sieges, at York on Shrove Tuesday, 1555. The young men showed the mayor, aldermen, and commons honest and pleasant pastime, one sort in defending a fort and the other in making the assaults. And on New Year's Day, 1557, Trinity College, Cambridge put on a show of the winning of and hold and taking of prisoners with weights, trumpets, guns, and squibs. When Elizabeth visited Bristol in 1574, she watched from a timber scaffold as 300 arquebusiers and 100 pikemen assaulted two forts in the marsh. Yet being able to use a weapon was not the same as being a soldier. As Henry Barrett put it with regard to handgunners, although to other uses they can right well use the same, they were oft times in warlike points ignorant. Thomas Audley, who wrote a military treatise for Edward VI, reckoned that a captain might make a recruit a man of war meet to serve within a fortnight, though he never saw wars before. But this was a good captain, taking a little pains, and Audley thought that under an incompetent, men might go 4 or 5 years in the wars, and in the end, never the wiser. What material did captains have to work with? It's much harder to identify those sent out to fight among drafts from the county militia than among those recruited in retinues, but town records can help. Throughout the period, urban authorities put some effort into picking the good, sad, and able men requested by the Crown. From the 1480s to the 1510s, they were often craftsmen. For Scotland in 1481, Coventry found 7 tailors, 4 shearmen, 4 shoemakers, 3 smiths, 2 cappers, 2 dyers, 2 wire drawers, 2 butchers, 2 yeomen, and 15 other artisans, ranging from a locksmith to a haberdasher. Into the 1540s and 50s, towns like York, Guildford, and Worcester included such men in their contingents, respectable guildsmen, minor office holders, and taxpayers. But there seems to have been a steady decline in status, summed up by Wilton, which sent a future mayor to Bosworth in 1485 and a future constable to Boulogne in 1546. The process was clearest at London, where the livery companies apparently operated a sliding scale, by which company members served in the defence of the city and were sometimes sent against rebels elsewhere in England, but were seldom dispatched overseas. Even when the younger members of the company were nominated to serve abroad, they were increasingly allowed to find substitutes. The results could be dire. The carpenters, drapers, pewterers, and skinners each found that men they had got ready to serve in the 1540s, 50s, or 60s ran away before they could be sent off. And in 1560, the drapers averted this only by keeping their 2 recruits in the city counter prison overnight. The distinction made in London looks much like that developing in the towns in the Netherlands, between the schutters, solid burghers who served in militias for the defence of the town and the maintenance of public order, and poorer men or country folk recruited to serve on campaign. Yet desperation might overcome it. For the relief of Calais in 1558, the carpenters did send out company members, both those bound apprentices in 1549 to 50, so presumably in their 20s, and with settled, if undistinguished, careers ahead of them, and those who'd been freemen since the mid-1540s, so presumably in their 30s, and had watched the walls of London against Wyatt. Amateur soldiers were important because there were so few professionals. As is often pointed out, no standing army like the French Compagnie de l'Ordonnance or the Spanish Tercios. At court, there were a few hundred guards. The standing naval establishment was small. The garrisons of Calais and its satellite fortresses totaled between 700 and 900 men, Berwick less than 100, Carlisle fewer still. In Ireland, English armies of between 200 and 700 served successive governors until the revolt of 1534 brought a permanent establishment ranging from 1,000 to 2,500. Around the English coasts, Henry's fortifications held garrisons totaling some 300 men, around half of them gunners, while some 2 dozen gunners worked at the Tower of London. The professional military establishment of mid-Tudor England then numbered a few thousand at best. Yet they were disproportionately important. Calais, and later Ireland, provided a reservoir of expertise for other expeditions and nurtured those 2 great spokesmen for the hard done by Tudor soldier, Ellis Griffith and Thomas Churchyard. Yeomen of the guard, king's spears, gentlemen pensioners and full-time gunners stiffened English armies, navies and garrisons. And the handbook authors, Audley and Barrett, were a Calais veteran and a yeoman of the guard, respectively. Beyond this corps was a penumbra of semi-professionals. Armourers often had fighting skills, and six men identified as armourers or surnamed armourer served in retinues in 1492 and two in the companies mustered at Canterbury in May 1514. Park keepers and foresters were expected to be good archers, and the foresters of Sherwood Forest supplied 15 archers for Sir Thomas Lovell's retinue in 1508, five of whom had served him in 1492. More alarming for contemporary moralists were what John Hooper, firebrand Bishop of Gloucester, called such as are every man's for money, such as these runagates and lance knights are, that sell both body and soul to such as will hire them. They care not whether the cause be wrong or right. England was not an exporter of mercenaries on the scale of Switzerland or Germany or Albania. But throughout our period, Englishmen fought and died for money in other people's wars. In the troubled Netherlands of the 1470s, 80s and 90s, hundreds served both the Valois and Habsburg Dukes of Burgundy under famous captains like Sir Thomas Everingham and Sir John Middleton, and the Duke's rivals, the Flemish cities, under less well-known contemporaries, like John Edward, whose local wife, Jeanne von Leerde, collected the wages of his company at Ghent. From then until the 1540s, Englishmen fought in smaller numbers. The adventurous, the desperate, or young gentlemen looking for military education. Then in the 1550s, as the dissolution of the English garrisons in Scotland and at Boulogne sharply diminished opportunities in royal service, hundreds served on each side in the wars between France and the Habsburgs. Footmen, light horsemen, and expert miners, among them future Elizabethan captains like Richard Bingham, William Drury, Nicholas Malby, and William Pelham. These English mercenaries had specific skills. Often they were archers, their fire falling as thick as snow. But they were not stuck in the past. By the 1550s, the light horsemen fought with pistols and boar spears like the Albanians and Germans alongside them. Many may have trained among the adventurers, runaway apprentices or soldiers dismissed for drunkenness, said some contemporaries, who served for plunder rather than pay on the fringe of English armies in campaign after campaign from 1492 to 1562 and daily learned feats of war. Mercenaries and adventurers alike had a reputation for pillage and for ruthless burning of the enemy countryside. As the Count of Reuss, Habsburg governor of Flanders, put it, when it comes to burning, it is necessary to use the English. Such behaviour invited reprisals. Some Englishmen were burnt alive in 1485 in the town hall of Hulst, where they had barricaded themselves after the inhabitants turned on them. In 1524, a party of adventurers cattle rustling out of Guienne found themselves hopelessly surrounded by French troops from the Boulogne garrison and surrendered. Their captors sold them to the peasants of the village they had been raiding, who massacred them. In revenge, their colleagues burned the village down 2 days later, killed 36 prisoners, and sent the one survivor to Boulogne as a warning. When it came to getting more ordinary recruits to fight, recruiters and captains recognized the importance of morale. Audley saw that captains needed chiefly to know what goodwill their men have to fight. For when soldiers determine themselves for to abide the fight and to give the manly onset, one man is worth two men. When preparing to assault Boulogne, Henry's commanders wanted the captains to feel the disposition of their soldiers. Fatigue was also seen to dent capability. As Audley put it, wearied men, if they be assailed in time of his weariness, is half overcome already by the reason of his weariness. Desertion must have indicated either unwillingness to fight or disillusionment, and seems to have been a steady trickle. Not only in dire straits, Lord Ferrers's men going back to Herefordshire in 1513 rather than mount a new raid on the French coast where they'd suffered heavy losses, or the Earl of Rutland's in 1549 slipping away from the beleaguered, underfed and plague-ridden English garrisons in Scotland, but also at the outset of campaigns. Mutinies were recurrent, when soldiers felt their interests threatened by interruptions to pay or by disastrous strategic choices. At Guienne in 1558, Lord Grey de Wilton's men urged him to surrender after a bloody siege. At first, they asked him to have consideration of their lives, which as long as any hope remained, they willingly had ventured. When he refused the French terms as insufficiently honourable, and urged, "Let us end then as honesty, duty, and fame doth will us," they, in a mutiny, flatly answered that they for his vain glory would not sell their lives, and he had to concede. Mutinies might split armies. In 1523, one body of troops shouting, "Home, home," was confronted by another chanting, "Hang, hang." It may well be that the change in recruitment from the retinue system to the more impersonal system of county drafts made it harder to hold armies together and inspired the move to fiercer and more regularized disciplinary procedures evident from the 1540s. In the heated atmosphere of 1549, mere withdrawal from musters could result in proclamation as a rebel and the confiscation of goods. In rebellions, of course, desertion might actually mean changing sides, as people did in 1554, both from the Queen's forces to Wyatt's and from the rebels to the Queen. On the other hand, the practice of granting leave must have meant that soldiers were trusted to return to duty. Garrison captains granted written licenses to return home, which could be presented to local officials. Sometimes leave for a week or even a month were given for specific purposes, to buy replacement horses, recover health, or settle financial affairs. In combat, fear and disorder readily led to flight, and contemporaries powerfully evoked its mixture of rational self-preservation and irrational panic. At Solway Moss, the English skirmishers put the Scots in a shake until their advance became in a shake more than in warlike haste, and a well-timed attack sent them into headlong rout. At Haddon Rig, part of the ambushed English raiding force made off with its booty, another part began to trot and shortly fell into galloping, and then, for the most part of all the host, break rule and fled. At Edinburgh, the English troops under cannon fire from the castle fell into such a sudden rage and fear that, with such exclamation and cryings out upon no ground or cause, they began to flee so fast out of the town as by reason of the strait passage in the gate, the throng and press was so great that one of them was like to destroy another. In such episodes, good captains tried to stem the rush. Some dismounted to steady their men. As Wharton put it, "Seeing misorder there, I alighted off my horse with my bow." They could be surrounded and captured if the rest of the army melted away, as it did at Haddon Rig. But sometimes their efforts made all the difference. At the gates of Edinburgh, the defensive fire was such that the English attackers began to shrink and retire, but then the gentlemen gave the onset and made so sharp assault that the attack pressed on. In explaining how ordinary men could be brought to kill in war, we have to reckon with the association between authoritative manliness and physical force in 16th century society. A generation of debate has established that while late medieval and early modern England saw higher rates of homicide than the present, partly because many assaults that now end in A and E then ended in death from wounds or infection, neither was a hotbed of random violence. Violence, even assault in response to verbal insult, was purposive and expected to be proportionate. The king claimed the right to exercise legitimate violence in the punishment of crime and in war, a right he delegated to his judges and to his soldiers. But those soldiers, if mature men, were also used to exercising legitimate violence of their own, as parish constables dragging offenders to the stocks, as husbands, fathers, and masters disciplining members of their households. While young men aspired, sometimes transgressively, think of bawdy house riots, to use such force. New soldiers then were attuned to the targeted use of manly force, though not to senseless slaughter. In situations of confrontation, they were also used to a heightened language of dispute that threatened to maim or stab one's opponent, even when all that usually resulted was a shove or a trip or a beard pull. In such confrontations, neighbours or servants held back the assailant so that his honour was vindicated without his doing extreme harm to his rival. In war, there were no restraining friends. The idea that the king's wars were just, and therefore it was morally legitimate to use force in them, was widely circulated. Preachers told their hearers that, as Hugh Latimer put it, to fight against the king's enemies, being called unto it by the magistrates, it is God's service. Audley's model speech to the army before battle, Julie made repeated references to the king's rights and honour as the cause for which men were fighting. But it was much more passionate about the need for soldiers to bear yourselves manfully and nobly this day, for the hope and likelihood of victory lay in the manly hearts of men, which will ever show their faces with courage of lions towards their enemies, and not wretchedly turn their faces and show their weak backs to their enemies. While there were links in the muscles between wrestling, archery practice, and battle, manliness was the connection between them in the mind, heart, and stomach. William Forrest was worried that the deteriorating diet of Englishmen would prevent them from the manly feats of wrestling and shooting, and thus from defending their country. Manly and manful are terms that recur endlessly in commending valour in combat. It was the manliness of fighting that gave the entertaining world-timed upside-down kick to stories like that of Long Meg of Westminster, a heroine of pamphlets, ballads and plays, apparently based on a brothel keeper of the 1550s and 60s who had allegedly stood in for a soldier at Boulogne and beaten a Frenchman in single combat. Manliness, reassuringly, was not recklessness. The self-control and discretion that were features of ideal masculinity were also prized by military theorists. William Worcester made the distinction between the hardy man that suddenly, without discretion of good advisement, advanceth himself in the field to be held courageous, and the manly man who will so discreetly advance him that he will intend to have the overhand of his adversary and save himself and his fellowship. Barrett, similarly, thought that the hardy and valiant courage was best deployed with circumspection and when peril is pondered. This analysis applied even to the famous. One chronicler attributed the death of Sir Edward Howard to his too much hardiness, while some blamed the defeat at Ancram Moor on the overmuch courage of Sir Ralph Ure, warden of the Middlemarches. Particularly admired was the kind of steadfast conduct that has won medals in more recent wars. At Dixmowder, in 1489, John Pearson, a baker from Coventry, had his foot shot off by a gun but kept firing arrows, kneeling or even sitting down until the enemy fled. At Pinkey, Grader Wilton, leading a cavalry charge, was struck in the mouth by a pike which broke a tooth, went through his tongue and passed three fingers deep into the roof of his mouth. Yet he pressed on after the retreating Scots until, overcome by heat and loss of blood, he had to be revived with a firkin of ale. At Le Havre, the identical twins, Nicholas and Andrew Tremaine of Cullercombe Devon, fought inseparably, and when one was killed, the other stepped fatally into his place. Peer pressure must have been important in making men fight. As their ships sat off the Spanish coast, William Berry, master of the John of Kingswear, was reluctant to join other English captains to sail into a neutral Spanish port and attack the ships in search of French goods, contrary to his instructions from the ship's owners. The others told him it was more meter for him to keep sheep than to be master of any ship of war. More soberly, Barrett recognised the value of the politic and wise persuasions of ancient soldiers in convincing the ignorant to fight, which else might wish to flee. Audley built peer pressure into his tactical recommendations, suggesting that two or three ranks of the most experienced pikemen at the back of a square would keep in your men behind fleeing. Self-preservation also triggered violence. Alexander Shaw, rector of Colby in Norfolk, served Thomas Lord Howard as a shipboard chaplain in 1511. When it came to hand-to-hand fighting with Scottish pirates, as he told the papal curia when petitioning for absolution, if he had not fought against those despoilers and slayers of men, it is credible that he could not have escaped death. A group of adventurers cut off by the French in 1524 made a similar calculation. If anything save our lives, it must be God and our hardiness. If you see me begin to flee, slay me out of hand, said their captain. They cried God for mercy, kissed the earth, shook hands, and fought to the death. Such small group loyalty, often stressed by modern historians, must have been particularly strong in retinues raised among neighbours and kinsmen. In 1492, for example, the Earl of Oxford's retinue contained two or three men each with the surnames Amberley, Bottler, Bray, Brearley, Bull, Cannon, Davy, Fear, London, Philip, Tedder, Troughton, Warden, and Yule. Clearly some took to violence with an enthusiasm that unnerved those around them. This might be temporary and attributable to medical imbalance, as men thought themselves governed by their bodily heat, English borderers revenging themselves on Scottish raiders in the heat of their blood, or a captain explaining why he had to be restrained from fighting an insolent subordinate. I was at heat with him, as he with me, which I ought not to have been, but an extreme fume will make any man forget himself. But for some, it was more habitual. When Sir Ralph Ewer's body was identified after Ancram Moor, the Earl of Arran exclaimed, God have mercy on him, for he was a fell cruel man and over cruel, which many a man and fatherless bairn might rue. Where reports of others' raids are full of sheep and cattle, Ewer's recount his five-hour assault on Moss Tower, Eckford, where 37 Scots were killed and 80 taken prisoner, not a man of them unhurt. Ewer, it seems, had crossed the line drawn by Audley, who wished all good soldiers to be no more bloody than the law of arms doth require. But even Ewer had his limits. In November 1542, he and Ralph Bulmer attacked Coldstream Priory, which they had heard was full of local Scots and their goods. They hoped to summon it, storm it, and by the law of arms put all to the sack, taking revenge with slaughter for the recent killing of an English herald. But all the Scottish lay folk had gone, and they were met at the priory gates by the prioress and clergy in vestments with a cross. And thus, they admitted, were we disappointed to do any slaughter, unless we should utterly have shamed ourselves forever. They contented themselves with burning down the buildings while the nuns knelt outside singing psalms. Greater Wilton seems to have rivaled Ewer's ferocity, though again he bound himself by the law of arms. In taking a fortified church from the French in 1557, he refused a surrender offered too late, citing the law of arms, and saw the entire garrison killed. Such predispositions ran in families. Ewer's brother Henry was described by Ralph Bulmer as a very free burner, and Grey's admiring son was an enthusiast for brutal conquest in Elizabethan Ireland. Sometimes heavy losses drove men into atrocities. At Dixmowder, the English, sent to fight the Flemish rebels and their French allies, lost some 500 men, including Henry Lovell, Lord Morley, in a frontal attack down a narrow road against a fortified position. When they broke through, there was not only much killing among the Flemings, 2,000 or more, but a deliberate massacre of the French. 500 or 600 of them took refuge in a building, reportedly crying out, "Ransom, ransom, we're just soldiers, we don't care about these Flemings." But the English, pretending not to understand, put all but 50 to the sword. The claustrophobic world of shipboard combat drove some in the same direction, especially when torture might discover the hiding place or ownership of goods. One English privateering crew of the 1540s tormented their captives by tightening bowstrings around their hands and privy members, and another in the 1570s hanged the master of a Dutch ship till he was half dead. Once he revealed where his money bags were, they weighted him with stones and threw him into the sea. Did soldiers who returned to England bring such behaviour with them? Social commentators worried that they might, that soldiers, beginning with excessive drinking and abominable swearing and seducing women to ungodly living, might end with much worse. Certainly some were uncouth. Portsmouth's master gunner allegedly pleaded with the town council until they made him a burgess, but then told the mayor that the honour was worthless. If it had been worth a turd or a clout to wipe his shoes, he should not have had it. Soldiers did sometimes commit robberies, steal horses, fight murderously among themselves, or carry out killings in family feuds. But men who were not soldiers also did such things. And perhaps men inclined to violence were more likely to become soldiers. Recruitment in the Hundred Years' War clearly linked service to pardon for violent crime. Hence, perhaps Edward IV's repeated assertion that the best means for justice to be set up and sure peace to be kept inwards was a notable and mighty war outwards. In 1480, 1545, and 1563, men were recruited straight from prison. Some soldiers were arrested as vagrants on their way to join up, and some families dumped their problems on the army. In 1514, Lord Darcy told the treasurer of Berwick to take his cousin's bastard son, Percival Wortley, into the garrison, however unthrifty and drunken you shall find him. Perhaps contemporaries got the balance right when they thought of the restless drawn to soldiering, being indeed such manner of men as were somewhat unruly before they were sent, returning not unlike now to be further out of frame, likely to take boldness to offend the king's subjects. But did many soldiers come home anyway? We know some did, as they were paid when they handed their equipment back in, though it's not clear most of those had made it out of England. Others did not, as they made wills, being in the king's warfare, hurriedly providing for their families as best they could. Death rates are hard to calculate, but they seem often to have been surprisingly low. Flodden and Pinkey were bloody encounters, but English losses were far less than Scottish. Perhaps 1,500 at Flodden, something over 5% of the English force, and half that number, a rather lower proportion, at Pinkey. On northern border raids, those slain in combat were counted in handfuls, and even in major encounters, English losses came in tens and twenties, Ancram-Moore worst at around 180. Again and again, English commanders filed reports like Wharton's of the 14th of February 1544, "We brought all the King's Majesty's subjects home without loss of any." Nor did the English slay many Scots, for the incentives lay not with killing the enemy, but with capturing him for ransom, or driving him away while taking his livestock and goods. Coastal raids and those mounted from Calais seem to have been similar. A dozen, a score, exceptionally 50 men lost out of parties of up to 1,000 or more. Even large expeditions might not be too costly. In a four-month campaign involving three sieges in the Netherlands in 1511, Sir Edward Poynings lost less than 100 out of 1,500 men. In 1513, most companies apparently came home almost complete, though there is some suspicion that payment was claimed for absentees. In September 1557, after 2 months of campaigning and the storming of Saint-Quentin, the English army counted fewer than 2% of its men dead and a handful taken prisoner. Naval engagements, when whole ships burnt up or went down with their crews, the Regent in 1512, the Mary Rose in 1545, or when boarding parties lost more than half their strength, were terrible, but sufficiently rare to be notorious, while naval gunnery was not yet sufficient to produce the storms of timber splinters that made the Restoration Navy such an apocalyptic place to fight. Some theatres were more deadly than others. In Ireland, tens or scores were killed in quite small encounters, and recurrent rebellions exacerbated the tendency to treat all enemies as rebels and hang or behead those not killed in combat. Losses were similarly heavy in domestic rebellions. Perhaps 100 of the Marquess of Northampton's men were killed in their expulsion from Norwich in 1549, a proportion comparable to that of the English losses at Flodden. While the Norfolk rebels may have lost 1 in 6 of their strength at Norwich and Dussindale, a proportion 3 or 4 times higher than Flodden. And the southwestern rebels at Fenny Bridges, Cliff St Mary and Samford Courtney, many more, nearly half their total force. No wonder Grader Wilton said that he had never been in such murderous fighting as that outside Exeter. When armies returned home much smaller than they started, the cause was usually epidemic disease. In September 1557, only 74% of the English troops in Picardy were fit to fight, because 5% had been sent home as too sick or disabled to continue, most of them among the pioneers, and a staggering 19% were sick or hurt but still in the camp. The sick, amid a major outbreak of what was probably influenza, outnumbering the wounded by 5 to 1. 7 weeks later, when the army crossed from Calais, only 53% of the men in companies that can be traced throughout the campaign were still under arms. But how many of the sick and wounded had died, and how many been sent home, we can't tell. Probably many were like Sir William Courtney, who survived the fighting unscathed, but made his will when visited with bodily sickness and died on the 29th of September. At Le Havre in June 1563, plague was taking 500 soldiers, about a tenth of the garrison, each week. And when the troops were evacuated to Portsmouth, the parish registers show what happened. 18 people were buried from April to June, 222 from July to September, some soldiers, but also many townsfolk. The same coincidence of war and disease worried local authorities in 1558. York cancelled its Corpus Christi plays, as the time was both troublesome with wars and also contagious with sickness. And muster commissioners were told to avoid calling too many people to one place, lest the infection of this common sickness be thereby occasioned further to spread. Even in Ireland, disease was a major factor. Of 220 yeomen of the guard who accompanied the Earl of Surrey there in 1520, 18 were dead within 4 months, probably of the plague, and a year later he'd lost perhaps a quarter of his army to the plague and the flux. Joining an army was dangerous then, but not necessarily more dangerous than moving to a city. A quarter of Londoners died in the plague year of 1563, and at Norwich some epidemics were worse than that. In armies, death rates from infected wounds must have been high, as they were in everyday accidents, but wounds were certainly not left untreated. Barrett recommended each company should have a surgeon able to extract bullets and salve inflammation. Named surgeons featured in retinues in 1492, 1508, and 1513, and Sir John Gage, who had fought in Scotland and France in the 1540s, had among his campaign gear a little tent for a surgeon. Thomas Gale, surgeon at Montreuil and Saint-Quentin, and author of a treatise on gunshot wounds designed to help the army at Le Havre, claimed to have found 72 surgeons at London to serve on land and sea in a single year. And the fleet recruited at least 15 surgeons at London in 1562-3. The professional pride and practical skill of some surgeons are evident from the finds belonging to the barber surgeon of the Mary Rose. Yet the sudden demand in wartime let in all manner of unsuitable candidates. Gale complained that at Montreuil he found men being treated by sow gelders and cobblers, whose abilities beyond cutting and sewing must have left something to be desired. Captains on land and sea, parishes, towns, and livery companies provided medical care or at least relief for their wounded, sometimes at substantial cost. Christopher Coo, captain of the John Baptist in 1522-4, spent £6.18 on care for 16 men burnt at the capture of a French ship. At Norwich in 1549, Captain Thomas Drury paid a local surgeon £1.13.4 for treating his wounded men. Medical discharge was also available. In winter 1513, 36 sailors who were sick and could no longer do service were sent home from the fleet at Portsmouth. Those who fell sick on the campaign of 1523 were allowed to go home on passports. In 1544, the Duke of Norfolk was sending so many men home sick from Montreuil that he had to appoint a four-man committee to weed out malingerers. And in the 1560s, the Navy issued standard form passports for sick sailors. Spiritual health was also a concern. Barrett thought each company should have a minister to lead prayers, preach, give communion, and exhort the sick, wounded, and those in extremity to godliness, and chaplains were regularly present, from the friar who accompanied York's troops in 1482 to the five priests serving with the companies at Canterbury in 1514 and beyond. Those permanently incapacitated might become dependent on charity or reward. Henry VIII gave the constableship of Tenby Castle to a man sore hurt and maimed at Blackheath, and a pension to a gunner blinded at Morley. He also made provision in the new cathedrals he set up in the wake of the dissolution of the monasteries for up to 124 men decayed or maimed in the King's Wars to pray and help with cleaning and bell ringing if they could. The life was comfortable enough that some of them survived for years. Occasionally their appointments recited their services. John Watson had served Henry, Edward, Mary and Elizabeth in wars in France and Scotland and had been maimed in the left hand before he joined Peterborough Cathedral in 1571. Henry also gave places in his father's almshouse at Westminster to veterans like John Long, who lost his leg at Boulogne. But royal provision can never have sufficed. Before the Reformation, bishops issued indulgences for alms collecting to individuals like Ralph Pudsey, disfigured by a wound that destroyed his upper jaw in Henry's first wars, but still alive in 1521. And hospitals and almshouses occasionally provided for maimed soldiers, as they did more explicitly by the 1560s. Alms payments to soldiers, whether wounded or just in poverty, appear in the household accounts of the aristocracy and gentry, in church wardens' accounts, in guild or borough accounts. Captains paid alms to those who had served under them or to their widows. As the poor laws tightened restrictions on begging, special provision had to be made. Robert Copeland's treatise of the 1530s, The Highway to the Spittlehouse, showed some sympathy to soldiers out of wages who should be found work, but complained about vagabonds begging in soldiers' clothing. In 1546, disbanded soldiers in London were given licenses to beg, to avoid the sort of scene glimpsed at Norwich in December 1561, when Edmund Abbott was hauled before the Court of Aldermen for begging on the city streets. Reading the exhaustive exchange, one begins to suspect that Abbott had latched onto a reader of the rogue pamphlets that warned of the elaborate lengths to which vagrants would go to sham respectable poverty. The Speedwell was a real galley, and there had been squadrons sweeping the narrow seas and the Solent, so his story is plausible, but that's the most we can say. War was a trial, but many survived it. Military service might cause homesickness. Kuntrich Hanmer wrote a poem from France about how he missed Llanorgain, or family concern. Margaret Paston told her eldest son, Sir John, in 1475 to keep an eye on his brothers, as they were but young soldiers, and what full little what it meaneth to be as a soldier. Sometimes the problem was not what went on at the wars, but what went on at home. Thomas de la River of Bransby, Yorkshire, claimed that while he was away for 3 years on the borders, John Barton came frequently to his house and successfully urged his wife Anne to accomplish his unlawful, voluptuous, and carnal appetite and desire with her. To be fair, Barton claimed that de la River invented the story because his wife reproved him for abominably using himself with one Jane Wilden. But the tale of wartime adultery must have been believable. Henry made intense efforts to militarize his subjects, but did these in the end demilitarize them? Sending the yeoman farmers, who had turned out for Blackheath, on long campaigns in France soon cooled their ardor. Ellis Griffith complained of the many wealthy farmers from Essex and Suffolk, those who were thinking of their wives and children and husbandry, who mutinied rather than prolong the campaign of 1523 into the biting winter. Henry's large armies could only be raised by including men like this, who were not what Griffith called those men of the common soldiers who had set their mind on being men of war. But repeated attempts to conscript them made them more likely to avoid service. They were the men who owned arms and armor, but now the government was telling them to make that equipment available to others rather than to use it themselves, or to contribute to township arms on the latest model. They were the men who had honed their archery skills by hours at the butts. But now the government was telling them that while archery practice was a good thing, it was guns that won wars. They were the men, as church wardens, aldermen, parish constables, and the better sort of parishioners, who had to manage the new systems and send their younger, poorer, less secure neighbours to an uncertain fate in Elizabeth's wars. In large numbers in total, it's true, but only a few thousand at a time. They kept their armour to the musters of 1569 and beyond. But if they used it at all, it was in the trained bands, a force designed, like the retinues their grandfathers had joined, to win a short civil war, throw back an invasion, or put down a revolt, rather than to rot in the siege trenches of the Netherlands, Ireland, or France. There are parallels with other aspects of Henry's rule. His pressure for wartime taxation raised unprecedented sums, but encouraged the slide into local underassessment that crippled the tax system from Elizabeth's reign to the Civil War. His reforms in the church led for many of his subjects not to enlightened faith, but to bewilderment and perhaps apathy or disenchantment. It would be charitable to assume that Henry lacked the foresight to appreciate these consequences, but some of those around him, one thinks of More's comment that if my head could win him a castle in France, it should not fail to go, suspected that as long as his honour and his appetite were satisfied in conquest, he did not care. To these wider relationships between kings, peoples, governance, and commonweal, we shall turn our attention next week.